Hi, I'm Kathy Forstein, music director at KC Cafe Radio. We're very happy to have Texas singer-songwriter Jim Chestnut as an artist playing on KC Cafe Radio. Jim is a true country music artist. He began his recording career in the late 60s, and in the early 70s, he teamed up with Rodney Crowell. By the late 70s, he was signed as an artist with the renowned publishing company Acuff Rose. Fast forward a few decades and many life changes later, Jim is back recording again with his newest album, This Guy Sings. Thanks so much, Jim, for taking the time to talk with me on KC Cafe Radio.
It's a pleasure.
You've had such an amazing career. I wanted to ask you about why did you title this newest album, This Guy Sings?
I don't know if I have a simple answer to anything like that. It just seemed like a good idea at the time. Maybe I can answer it this way. There are, around here in South Texas where I am, there are singers who play guitar and guitar players who sing. And I am a singer who plays guitar. And so I thought, well, This Guy Sings might be, it puts an emphasis on the singing and not the guitar playing.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I don't want anybody to think of me as a guitar player. I mean, I play enough to accompany myself, but I wouldn't want to try to hire out, you know what I mean? Like
right.
A side player.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I mean, you're known as a singer-songwriter anyway, so I think to me that's a perfect way to title yourself, is that, you know, because you're really known as being a songwriter and a singer.
Yeah, and I think singers come in two varieties. There's the presentational singer, which is kind of the stand on stage and move with the song, and there's as much visual in it as there is oral.
Mm-hmm.
But I am more of an interpretive kind of singer, or I like to think of myself that way. I like to try to bring the best of any song out that I'm happen to be doing, not just to get through it, but to bring meaning and passion to the listener by means of the performance.
Yeah, I agree. I much more enjoy singers who are there to present the song rather than present themselves. I think the song should be the star and not necessarily the singer, you know.
Well, I agree. And the older I get, the uglier I get. So I'm not
That's not true. So you grew up in Texas. What were you listening to there in Texas as a kid?
You are not going to believe this. I wasn't listening to country music. I grew up in a Methodist church in Midland, Texas, and mm-hmm. I'm influenced by a lot of church music, formal music training. My mother saw to it that I had piano lessons and voice lessons when I was a youth and a teenager. And country music came to me when I started in radio, oddly enough, when I was about 19. I discovered radio. I went to Odessa Junior College for a couple of years, and they had a campus radio station, and I discovered that and applied for a student position and got that, and the next year became student station manager. I was in radio after that for about 5 years in Odessa, San Angelo, and Austin, Texas,
mm-hmm.
and I worked for country radio stations,
mm-hmm.
and that's when I kind of got into the country music thing. My first foray into doing music for a living was, I guess you would call, middle-of-the-road pop kind of stuff. Went to L.A. and was fortunate enough to meet three people who all told me the same thing. You need to go to Nashville because we feel like that's where your voice would fit best. And those three individuals were a guy named Glenn Hardin, who had been Elvis Presley's piano player, and Bob Webb, who was Jimmy Webb's dad, and Leon Russell.
Oh.
And all three of those people told me the same thing, so I thought, okay, I could take a joke. So, hooked it over to Nashville, and I think I made about three trips over there before being signed. I was fortunate enough to record a demo session in Garland, Texas, with some unexpected money I got. And I took those three songs over to Nashville, and one of the stops I made was at Charlie Pride's office. And in those years, you could walk in and say, hey, I'm a songwriter, I'd like to leave something, and,
mm-hmm.
and you could. I don't think that's true today. I have trouble getting in to see even Sony Music has my early catalog, and I have trouble getting in to see appropriate people.
Mm-hmm.
Even at Sony. The market up there is not as open as it was in my middle and late 70s when I was making my trips. So anyway, I left the tape there at Charlie Pride's office, and I got a call about a week later and indicating that Pride wanted to record one of the songs called Oklahoma Morning, and I ultimately agreed to that, and I had a one-song publishing deal with his company. And once that was done, then I went to Nashville again and made some phone calls and said, I'd like to play you some material. The only credit I have is that Charlie Pride just cut one of my songs. Well, come on over, they said. And so I went to A-Cup Rose, and they sat down and listened to my tape and offered me a writing position on the spot. A month after that, I got a recording deal through them with MGM Records. That's another, I think, interesting story. A-Cup Rose had a five-artist package deal with MGM Records, and it was called MGM Hickory, because Hickory Records was the label that A-Cup Rose owned. Mm-hmm. And they said, we want to add Chestnut in there for the, and they said, well, it's full. So Roy A-Cup volunteered to step aside and let me take his place. And I think his words, as told to me, were, I've cut enough records, give this kid a chance. And, wow. I'll never forget that generosity. I mean, who would do that today?
Yeah, but, that's unheard of, yeah.
Anyway, that's how I got started over there with A-Cup Rose and Hickory.
Do you know who the other four artists were that were on the label?
Yes, I do. If I hope I don't leave somebody out. Mickey Newberry was one, Don Gibson, Don Eberle, mm-hmm. Carl Smith, and Roy A-Cup.
Wow. That's pretty good company to be in.
No kidding.
Wow.
I mean, I'm not quite as arrogant as I was back then, but even then, as arrogant as I was, full of myself, I couldn't believe the good fortune. I mean, it was just like, who gets this opportunity?
Yeah, no kidding. So did you write other songs for other artists as well at that time?
Well, let me tell you, I did probably the dumbest thing that I've ever done career-wise. When I got signed to A-Cup Rose and got the record deal, I froze all of my own songs for my own use. And Wesley Rose, the president and, you know, main guy there at the company, tried to talk me out of it. He said, you'll make more money writing songs than you will performing. And my ego wouldn't hear that. And so they honored it. And I now regret that because, obviously, it would have been nice to have some other artist cut some material that I could listen to their versions. I get tired of my own stuff. Mm-hmm. But now it's virtually impossible to get songs into artists that are in vogue. Companies are more vertically inclined, meaning that record labels own publishers and they have teams of writers in-house, and it's very, very difficult to get through with any material mm-hmm. that penetrates that wall that exists. And it's not just me. I mean, Don Schlitz, who wrote The Gambler and a bunch of other songs for Randy Travis, told me the same thing about 3 years ago at a music festival. He said, you know, at the time he told me, he said, I hadn't had a songwriting career in 15 years mm-hmm. because the industry has got so closed off. Well, so his advice to me was stay home in Texas and build your own deal down here and have some fun with it, make a little bit of money, but you won't be near as frustrated.
Right. You'll probably have a better time doing it.
Well, yeah. It is fun, and I'm having more fun than I had back then. Thanks to folks like you and your support, the music. It's been quite a journey. Yeah. But I didn't particularly listen to Don Schlitz. I have hooked it back to Nashville a couple of times, and I may still land some kind of a subcontract deal. I'm not interested in moving there. I'm not interested in becoming part of a stable or team writing, as so much of it is done today. I don't know how a committee writes a song. I can understand how two people might get together and do a collaboration that benefits the song, but when you get four or five names on a song, there's something else going on there.
Right.
Let's sit here in the conference room and write a song today. I mean, that's just not...
Yeah, I think a lot of it, what happens too, is say, I mean, I'm just taking a name, I'm not pointing fingers, but just like an artist like Taylor Swift, you know, she has her name on all these songs, but then you notice that there's four other songwriters on those songs. And you have to really wonder what was really her contribution to that song, you know?
My own opinion of that is that she wrote it. Mm-hmm. And out of the kindness of her heart, she cut in some other people who may have had some minor input mm-hmm. in it. But I may be not too popular for saying this, but I'm a huge fan of Taylor Swift. I'm not particularly a fan of her music, but what she's been able to do and the market she's been able to reach, I think is brilliant. I don't think it's country, but I think it's brilliant.
Yeah, and she's one of the few people who've found a way to actually make money from downloads and stuff, because downloads are just, I think it's killing the industry. I don't know how you feel about it.
Well, if I were a record label, I would be looking at it differently than as an artist. But here's the thing. Every time somebody listens to one of my songs, an individual listens to one of my songs on Spotify, I get paid 0.0075 cents.
Right.
So that means that with 100 listeners listening one time, I make 7.5 cents. Okay. Mm-hmm. That sounds to some people unfair, but back in my day, when terrestrial radio was the only gateway to listening to music besides owning the music, in a major market, they paid about a nickel a spin. It might have been a little more than that, but I think that's what it was in a major market.
Mm-hmm.
If you had an average quarter hour audience of 100,000 people, and that record was played during that quarter hour, divide that nickel by 100,000, and it's a whole lot less than 0.0075 cents. So for those people who can get a number of spins generated on Spotify, it's not a bad deal at all. But you just have to put in your homework to build that kind of following through the internet. And be aware, and I'm not saying we have to welcome the new technology with open arms, but listen, the reality is a majority of people are getting their music through a smartphone now.
Right.
And what's so interesting to me is that I've spent untold hours in control rooms, fine-tuning, getting just the right mix. And then when somebody listens to it on a speaker that's about the size of a dime, I think, why did I go to all this trouble?
Right.
I went to all the trouble for me, but the reality is people are listening to music in all kinds of devices that aren't even as good as the transistor radios I grew up with.
Yeah, that's true. The music industry has just changed incredibly over the last 50 years. It's incredible to think about what we used to listen to and now we're listening to. And, you know, back when I was a kid, I used to go out and buy 45s by like 10 at a time, you know? And now I just buy one album and I've got 15 songs on there that are already downloaded to my phone.
Yeah.
So I was wondering, too, we go back to your early career. Do you come from a musical family?
I came from a family that was encouraging the music training. My mother played piano. She read music. She didn't play well, but she read music a whole lot better than I do. But as far as being singers, I never really heard anybody around the house sing except my brother. He's older than about 8.5 years older than I am, and he sang quite a bit, just, you know, around the house and sang in choirs and stuff like that. So I had that influence, but I'm probably the first one in all the cousins once and two times removed to have been stupid enough to get into the music business.
Mm.
But I don't mean to put all that down, except that it's a pretty tough business to be in. And fortunately, I've been married a couple of times to women who were somewhat supportive and took the load of raising a family off, because it is really hard. Now, you know, when I first got started, my first commercial singing job was in 1970, and I got heard by a country radio station manager in San Angelo, Texas, and he introduced me to a Holiday Inn innkeeper who was moving to Dallas, and he hired me to come up there and be a six-night-a-week lounge singer. And shortly after that, within a few months, my first wife became my drummer, but, and so we had a trio. Rodney Crowell played bass with us for a few months. And then after he left for Nashville, then she and I became a duo in the Dallas and East Texas area. And we made equivalent to today's money, if you plug it into one of those inflation calculators, we made over $100,000 a year.
Wow.
Now, that's not including the fact that we lived on the road in free hotel rooms. Mm-hmm. And sometimes we had meal deals, and sometimes it was always half price. But it was a very good living for a musician. Yeah. Well, and that was kind of starting at the bottom, so to speak. Those jobs don't exist anymore because you don't have the sit-down gigs that run 6 nights a week. And if they did, if they kept up with what they paid us back then, well, they couldn't afford that kind of money. But it was a great way to start, and it was a great way to keep my interest in progressing into bigger and better kinds of things. If I were starting out today and starving like most of the people are that I know in the business who have, you know, they maintain full-time jobs somewhere else and then they play wherever they can just occasionally, it would be hard to have a dream. It would be hard to fulfill the dream of becoming known or a recording artist or whatever on the one hand. On the other hand is now the technology is somewhat affordable, and if you've got a spare bedroom in your house, you can set up a recording rig and make your own CDs. That feeds the creative soul a little bit. It may not get you signed to a major label, but
It might not feed your kids, but but you can at least be creative and have a quality product out there. What do you think we can do? I mean, I'm one of those artists too. You know, I kind of come up against that wall too, where it's, you know, I want to play a gig, but I just don't. I also don't want to play a free gig every single time. I don't want to play for tips every single time, but that's really all that's out there that's offered to you as an artist. So what do you think we can do as artists to change
that?
I don't know
what you should do, but let me tell you what I'm doing. And then if you can get something from that, you're free to access it. I have the benefit of having been in the marketing communications field for quite a number of years, so I kind of understand what businesses are up against. And, you know, if you're talking about little restaurants and bars and so forth, a lot of them are mom and pops, and they simply do not know. They are hungry for someone to bring them business. And at first, I really resented that. I thought, you bring the business, and I'll help keep them happy. Well, that doesn't happen very often. So what I do is every gig I play, I ask for email addresses from people who seem to be paying attention to what I'm doing. And so I have built an email list of about 500 people over the past 3 or 4 years. And I send those out whenever I'm going to go to a gig. But whenever I go pitch somebody about playing there, I tell them, they say, well, do you have a big following? I said, well, honey, if I had a big following, I'd build a restaurant. And, you know, but I have a substantial following, and sometimes 20, 30 people can show up, depending on a lot of circumstances. So I pursue that, building that email list and increasing the engagement on social media so that I don't try to talk just about me and my music. I sometimes talk about other people's music. Sometimes I just do humorous things. And if I see a recipe for a food dish that I like, I'll throw that out there so that you become a person that somebody wants to be with rather than an ego-driven entertainment who's basically crying, look at me, and if you don't look at me, I'm going to get sad, or whatever. But, you know, it's just, everything I can read about that audience engagement tells you just to make it about 10 or 20% music and the rest of it about human relations. So that's kind of what I'm doing. And around here in my market in San Antonio, I did a state count of liquor licenses in beer and wine licenses in my market here, and there's something like 5,000 restaurants and bars who have licenses. That doesn't mean that they're going to hire you, but you know, it's a place to start, is to look up who's got licenses. It's public information, and then make a list and go call on them and be prepared to face a lot of rejection. They're not rejecting you as a person. They're, you know, rejecting a lot of times the reality of not being able to afford it. I had cancer last year, and before that, I had started an organization that I intend to put more energy into now that I'm through the treatment, but called Texas Live Music Association. And the purpose of that is to maximize the value of music in public performance. And that structure will have three components. It'll have venues, it'll have artists, and it'll have fans. And there's a certain benefit to each group for affiliating with the organization and adopting its standards. But here's the limitation. I feel like that if entertainers could cross-promote each other's gigs, it would raise the awareness of the benefit of live music in the community, both to the followers, the fans, and to the venues.
Mm-hmm.
But you would be surprised how many performers are hesitant to want to do that. There's a lot of ego involved. Well, I don't want a bunch. I just want some that'll play the game to the point that let's test it and see how it's working.
Right.
You know, if the thing were to grow and if you were to get, say, 100 artists involved, well, I can't cross-promote 100 people.
Mm-hmm.
But we could subdivide and each agree to cross-promote 5 so that, you know, an email might go out like, hey, this weekend, if you're tired of seeing me, be sure and check out my friend Bob or Clara or whoever, you know,
mm-hmm.
and here's what they do and here's where they're playing and get the whole idea of live music up in the conscious mind.
Mm-hmm.
And I think long term we could probably have some fun with it and do some good.
Yeah, I agree with you. I'm kind of involved in a group that's trying to do something like that too here in Kansas City, so we should talk.
Yeah, I would be happy to send you all the material that I've written. I'm a born late academic. I went back to school and completed an undergraduate degree that I left to go into the music business back in 1968 or so, or 70. So I completed a degree and became a certified public manager, which means that I concentrated on nonprofit.
Oh. Great.
And, well, I've never used it professionally. I was 65 when I graduated, so
mm-hmm.
not many people looking to hire 65-year-olds. But knowledge is never wasted. That training has informed me in my way of thinking and analyzing different performing opportunities. And
well, you have a lot of experience, too. I mean, you've been there, so you've been there, done that kind of thing. So
yeah.
Let's get back on track about your music here a little bit. You mentioned earlier that...
enough about me. Let's talk about you.
Let's talk more about you.
Okay.
So you mentioned earlier about meeting and working with Rodney Crowell. How did you meet Rodney? He must have been pretty young at that time.
Well, yeah. I think I'm about 5 or 7 years older than Rodney. I was in my late 20s, and he was a student at Stephen. I may be 10 years older. No, it's not quite. It doesn't matter. I was playing those Holiday Inn gigs, and I was working for a company that had 2 of them, one in Nacogdoches and one in Lufkin. We would go in there for 60 days and live in Nacogdoches, but work in one hotel 1 month and the next hotel the next month. And then on the 3rd month, we'd move up to Longview, which is in East Texas. So the manager at the Lufkin Hotel suggested that I go out and meet Rodney, who had talked to him about playing bass. He said, go talk to Rodney and see if y'all can work something out, and we'll increase the pay, and he can join you. Well, I got out of my car, and I was walking up to meet him. He was sitting on his steps of his dorm with his buddy, a guy named Donovan Cowart. And from 100 feet away, I saw really something special in Rodney. He reminded me of a Paul McCartney.
Really?
It had that kind of charisma.
Mm-hmm.
And I hadn't even heard him yet. You know, he was just hitting on the sports strumming the guitar, which I couldn't hear at that distance. But just watching him, I just knew that he had something. So we talked and made an arrangement. And he joined us, and we played. And then one night after hours, we were playing as a duo. And I think we had another guy named Woody Smith, who was a drummer. And we were up in Longview, and Rodney would come in on the weekends. Woody and I would play there during the week, and he would join us Fridays and Saturdays, so it would be a trio on the weekends. And one Saturday night after hours, the club was closed. The owner of the hotel was there, and Woody left to go home, and Rodney and I were just hamming it up with the people. And my first wife, whose name is Linda, decided that she was going to get up and play drums with her hands. And the owner looked at her, and he looked at me, and he said, I'll double your pay if you teach her to play drums and put her in the act. Well, okay then. You know, he got my attention. So Rodney and Linda went out the next day and bought a set of drums at a pawn shop for $50. And they were the most god-awful looking drums you ever saw. But he worked with her all day Monday and got her into the basics of it. And that week she started playing drums and we started making more money. And we played together for a good number of years, maybe 3 more years, maybe 4. And she only stopped when we had our second daughter. and I started playing as a single again. But then Rondi moved on to Nashville in pursuit of his career, which right. has been stunning.
Right, phenomenal, and, phenomenal songwriter.
Yeah.
So could you tell at that early time that he was going to be such a great songwriter?
No, and to be candid, I'm not sure I was thinking about him that much. I just knew that he was just a magic person. And I don't know that we did very many of his songs. I don't think we did very many of my songs. I think we were doing covers and just playing and entertaining people.
Mm-hmm.
I met him later in Nashville, 2 or 3 years later, after I had maybe signed my deal with Pickup Rose. And we went out listening to some other songwriters in town at a place called Bishop's, which is on West End Avenue. It's not there anymore, but he has a song. I heard it on Sirius XM the other day. The lyric in there refers to a dog named Banjo and a girl named Muffin.
Mm-hmm.
And that's true. He had a dog named Banjo, and I never met his girl named Muffin, but I do remember the dog. This is just something he picked up at the pound.
Very cool.
But Rodney, you know, he wasn't married, didn't have kids, and he was kind of free to go and hang out at the street level in Nashville and with Guy Clark and Newberry at times. And I was a married guy with a child, and I didn't have that opportunity, but I didn't want it either.
Mm-hmm.
I was more conventional.
Right. Yeah. Being with your family and yeah, that makes sense. When did you start writing? How old were you when you first started writing?
I was in my 20s. I was a student at UT Austin back in the late 60s. 66, 67, I got the notion to write a song. I have a sort of a interest in theology, having come up through the church and so forth. And through my, I went to 8 universities before I graduated, but one of those was a Catholic seminary here in San Antonio. I completed a program in lay ministry, which is a 2-year program over there. So I'm always, you know, really, I'm a seeker. Mm-hmm. I don't have anything figured out, especially. I just kind of like doing that stuff. I think maybe that first song was entitled In God's Mind, and theologically it was, I wonder if all this thing we call reality is just God's imagination.
Mm-hmm.
I played it for a couple of people, and they said, let's have more wine. I said, okay, I'm for
that. Would you say that was a country song or a gospel song?
Well, it wasn't anything. It was kind of folk.
It was a folky song? Yeah.
You know, but you know, I said my musical influences before, but I skipped over something. Back in my high school days, 62, 63, when I was a junior and senior, commercial folk music was very popular, you know, like Kingston Trio and Peter, Paul, and Mary. And I was in a couple of groups in that time frame. And then later in the 60s, was part of a folk choir in Odessa, Texas, called the Dan Blocker Singers. It was about 40 voices of young people. It was put together by a guy named Walter Dixon Bowles. Now, the reason it became Dan Blocker Singers was he was in town to do a theatrical presentation at our community college. He had been a drama student of a woman named Frida Powell, who was our drama teacher, and she had taught at Sol Ross University in Alpine, and Dan Blocker had been a student of hers, and they were very close. And so she brought him in with Lauren Green and Cornell Roberts and Michael Landon for a couple of years to do some interesting things in the community. So I'm about 6 feet tall, and I remember coming down the hallway and made a blind turn and ran into Dan Blocker, and I swear to God, I was looking at his belly button. That's the biggest human being ever. They were all big.
Gosh.
They were all real tall people.
Yeah.
But anyway, I got off on that. But the folk stuff the commercial folk stuff was pretty influential on me. You know, I loved Joan Baez and that kind of organic kind of music.
Yeah, I think country and folk are very closely related. I think there's a lot of commonality between them, you know, a lot of stories and songs, and a lot of passion in the songs as well, and humor.
Yeah, I agree. I think the instrumentation is the only thing that's different, but what I try to do, I have a mantra, kind of a marketing slogan, if you will, that I'm striving to keep music and country music, because I got to tell you, I know I'm old, but I just can't stand what's happened to country music in the last 10 years. It's lost its sense of melody. The range of topics has become more narrow. I mean, if I hear another song about a pickup truck and shaking booty and drinking beer and, you know, I'm going to puke. I know it's got its audience, but the problem, if I were running a record label, I would certainly pay heed to that because that's who's consuming music. But I would also do some developmental stuff and try to do something to keep the genre of the more standardized or classical, archetypical country music models going. Mm-hmm. Because it tells the human story. Now, yeah, there was a time in my youth when I would have been accused as being new age country and you're not country, you don't sing through your nose. I mean, I've heard it all. Mm-hmm. And that's true. We were all trying to get that pop country crossover in my day, and rather than paying attention to the roots. But at my age now, and because of, I hope, maturity, I am more interested in the more roots-driven music. You know,
right.
try to find what's at the foundation and build up from that.
Yeah. I think a lot of the country music today doesn't even sound like country music. I mean, they throw maybe a banjo or a fiddle in there for a couple of bars, and that, oh, it's a country song, you know. To me, it's just like a 70s rock song that they've just thrown a fiddle in. You know, it's got nothing to do with what country music actually is.
Are you old enough to remember who Festus was on Gunsmoke?
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yep. We watch Gunsmoke every week. My dad was a big fan.
To me, mostly the male singers in country music today all sound like Festus. You know, they put the sound up through their nose, and the dumber they sound, the better. Why not just be natural and organic, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. And to me, the female singers aren't much better. They all want to sound like, I don't know, a pop version of Lady Gaga, or, you know, they're trying to sound, they don't sound country at all. They sound right. More like a pop singer than they do a country singer.
Well, I think the term maybe, I think honesty is missing, and I'll describe honesty with Emmylou Harris. I think she was a very honest singer. And let's see, Jesse Coulter.
Mm-hmm.
I'm Not Lisa. Dolly Parton. You know, in my day, when you listened to the radio, one record would start, and when it ended, somebody else started, and they didn't sound alike. Each artist had its own, his or her own identity.
You could identify an artist by their voice, you know? You knew a Dolly Parton song when you heard it. You knew it was Dolly Parton's voice.
Yep.
Same with Emmylou Harris. You knew that was Emmylou Harris singing. Now you can't tell one from the other. You left the music industry probably in the early 80s. What precipitated you leaving the business?
I put a lot of effort into getting to the point where I could produce or co-produce my own work. And I finally achieved that. And I think I was with either Liberty or United Artists. They were the same company. They were part of the Capitol Records family. And I collaborated with the West Coast to choose the songs. And you know, it was a team effort. It was just that I was now being listened to some degree. And we put out a record called A Rose Is For Today. And I mean, it was beautiful. It had the kitchen sink in it. I mean, my dream in those days was, you know, to have full orchestration, because that's kind of the voice I thought I had. And we put out this beautiful record. It had been an album cut of Charlie Pride's. And I had a guy named Hal Jay at WBAP in Fort Worth told me in a social meeting one night, he said, "Man, here's a song you could do really well. You cut this, and at BAP, we will support this, and, you know, blah, blah, blah." So we cut it. And that was about 81. And it came into Billboard with a bullet, lost its bullet in the second week, and in the third week it was gone. And I was devastated. I mean, my first marriage to Linda had ended, and I was, by that time, staying drunk a lot. And I decided, sometime in that year I quit drinking, and I was sober a month, probably, when this record tanked. And then I had a pretty significant booking down here in South Texas, and I got a call 2 days before the booking, and the club burned.
They were canceling,
and I was depending on the income to make child support payments that month. And I just thought, well, Okay, God, I think you've been telling me something here all along I haven't been listening to, and I'm 37 years old, and I can see and feel younger people behind me, George Strait and Alan Jackson coming up, John Connolly and John Anderson and Mo Bandy, and it was shifting over to country.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, I've had a good run, but I think I should get out. So I called up the record label, which at that time, all my stuff was going through Curb Records in L.A. And I called them up and I said, I appreciate all the support you've given me and so forth, but I don't think I can do this anymore. And so they said, we understand. Nobody begged me to stay, you know, because there's always 50 people waiting to take your place.
Yeah.
So I started over. I was in Austin at the time, and I met my present wife, Christine. We've been married 37 years. And, well, I'm sorry, it'll be 36. We've been together 37 years. We'll be married 36 years, I guess, in August. And so I started over and went to work selling radio advertising and kind of got my taste of the ad agency business. So I started a little group and helped raise kids. Then after they got out, all their college was done and paid for, then I went back to school and completed mine and started doing music again. So
great.
I kind of got it all upside down, but at least I got to do it.
Yeah. One of your songs was used in a movie, probably like in 2007, 2008. Is that what was the big impetus to get you back into it again?
It certainly got my attention. I got a call back then from a guy named Steve Collum, who had been a co-writer at, another Acuff Rose writer. And I had recorded several of his songs. But he called me one day and said, hey, congratulations. I said, what for? He said, one of your songs is in an Ashley Judd movie. And I said, which one? He named it. I said, I don't think I wrote that. And he said, no, I wrote it. You recorded it. I said, oh, yeah, okay. Let's call Get Back to Loving Me. So I rushed around and found a DVD copy of the movie, and I listened to it. It had been remastered, and I thought, that sounds pretty good. And I started picking up some stuff around here locally and playing again. So thanks for bringing that up. I completely forgotten what the trigger was.
Yeah,
I was just
kind of reading through your bio and stuff and saw that, and I was like, I bet that's what got him back into doing this again. So you recorded an album right after that, then? You went back to the studios and did an album?
Yes, I did. The first self-produced album was called Reflections, and I got a guy named Bill Wentz. I think you probably know Bill over in Nolensville. I've been with him all this time as a promoter, and I thought of it as Americana at that point. It really, really wasn't very well defined as anything. It was just fairly good arrangements. But anyway, we got a little bit of indie chart action, but, you know, I think we got it up halfway or so in the Americana 500 chart, which is meaningless, but kind of whetted my appetite. And I have just completed my fifth self-produced album, which will be out next month.
Oh, awesome.
And this guy sings, and the one that I'm coming out with next, they're my babies. I've matured in the studio with my abilities to mix and engineer and all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I'm doing it all myself because I don't have any money. Also, I mean, I'm a former radio broadcast engineer, so it's not like I'm a dummy. I know something about that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm fortunate to have access to a studio I built, so it makes it affordable for me to be able to do it. Then I don't have anybody to blame but myself.
I'm sure it sounds great. And well, this new album, This Guy Sings, is wonderful. I want to ask you about a couple of the songs on it.
Okay.
One of the songs that I really like is the song True Love is a Dance in Three-Quarter Time. What was the inspiration for that song?
I don't know. I think living in a loving relationship, you go along and you start to take it and each other for granted. And my wife and I watch a lot of these dancing shows on TV.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, I just said to myself one night, true love is a lot like this Viennese waltz.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the male is going forward and then backward, and it's just a beautiful kind of dance. And then I worked on the song, and it more or less, yeah, I don't know if I have a method. What I think I do, if I had to analyze it, I think I write down hooks and then I try to build a story to fit the hook.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes it starts with the story and then have to work out the hook. But I think the hook is the hardest thing to find.
Yeah.
But I think that was probably it.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't write unless I'm doing an album. I keep a journal of all the hooks and the song ideas I may get, but I don't really work on it until I'm ready to put at least 10 songs together, because I want it to kind of flow and I don't want them to sound the same. And I try not to do anything in the same key back to back. Unfortunately, this new album's got two or three in the same key, but the tempos change, and so it's not monotonous. But I just think, yeah, I was in radio for so long that I think of myself when doing an album as programming records
right
on the air, you know, so that there's some variety.
Yeah, that's great. And were you always with country music radio, or did you do other radio stations as well?
Well, I did country radio first, and then I did some rock stuff for a short time. And that was in Odessa, Texas, at the leading AM station. The FM hadn't really gotten its wings in those years. That was about 68, 69, mm-hmm. somewhere in there. I said something on the air one morning that pissed the owner off, so he came in and fired me. I had a 54 share out of about 7 stations, which I thought was pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
But he didn't care. He was just a kind of a... He was a drunk, and I was a drunk. And, sorry, anyway. It happened.
Yeah.
It happened for the best.
Yeah. Sometimes things happen for the best. I've never had good luck with station managers either, so... I think it's the nature of the beast.
It is, and they've got a tough job to do, and he was never at work. He was off. Matter of fact, I think he used to leave West Texas and go to Kansas City, and he must have had a girlfriend or something up there. And anyway, you mentioned there were a couple of songs on the album you wanted to ask about.
Yeah, I was also going to ask you about Circuit Rider. What's that song come from?
That one is interesting, I think. When I was in the seminary program, 9 months of that was spent in an internship, and I was assigned to an inner-city Methodist church under the supervision of the pastor. And our task was to try to breathe new life into a dying congregation. And one of the things we did after the first year was to fire the choir and the organist, because it was terrible. I mean, the median age in the church was probably 75. Of course, now that I'm 73, it doesn't seem like 75 is all that old. But they were satisfying themselves, but if a visitor walked through the door, it would just be, you know, this is the pre-kindergarten to a funeral home. I mean, none of the young people would feel comfortable there. So I put together, was asked by the congregation. I mean, it wasn't a power struggle or anything. It was the bishop had commissioned us to go in there and do something. So I put together three jazz musicians and myself. We became known as Circuit Rider. The Methodist movement in the United States was created during the American Revolutionary War, because we were prevented from having a state church like England.
Mm-hmm.
So eventually, John Wesley, who was the father of Methodism, English Anglican pastor, commissioned a couple of people whose names, I think one named Ashbury, I don't remember the other guy, it doesn't matter. Anyway, so they started up the Methodist deal here in this country, and the West was pretty well colonized by circuit riding preachers who traveled on horseback and served little churches throughout the West. And I wrote the song in protest, as a metaphorical protest to the passage of the state lottery here in Texas.
Hmm.
We would rather do anything than pay taxes in Texas.
Mm-hmm.
And that includes paying $85 for your license tags, and you know, all kinds of user fees have gone up, but we haven't raised taxes. So politicians
yeah.
say that.
Mm-hmm.
But the lottery, it just takes money from the poor and puts it into the hopper.
Right.
And it was originally money that was going to be designated for education, but it quickly got swallowed up into the general fund.
Mm-hmm.
And so anyway, I didn't want to come out as a whining folk singer, you know, anti-lottery, so I wrote something that complains about the wishes of the town folk. They will build a hotel and casino, and that's going to be the panacea. They promised us a new school, and but it goes to hell. Well, that whole song is becoming a musical now that I'm working on. when you get the new album, you'll hear a couple of songs on that. One of them is called Working Man's Saturday Night. It goes with Circuit Rider, and the song following that is called Willing Woman, and that follows Working Man's Saturday Night in the musical, not in the album. But basically, it's the story of a fictional town west of Fort Worth in the middle 1880s, mm-hmm. and they build a hotel and casino and attract some tourists, and they attract some blue-collar mining workers who are there to blow off steam on the weekends, and it causes a bunch of trouble, and the place burns down, and they never do get their school, and I'm not going to go into the whole story for you, but anyway, I'm having fun developing that.
That sounds awesome.
I think it'll be a scalable kind of thing where it can be just a single singer-songwriter telling a story on a stool and then playing songs to illustrate different points in there. Mm-hmm. Different way to present music. There is just so much sameness out there in my mind where you go into a place and there's a singer-songwriter performing and the venue's the same and the songs all kind of sound the same and I get kind of bored. I know it's just me. So I try to present stuff in a little different perspective, and who knows?
That sounds like a great idea. You could even tour with that. I mean, that would be a great thing to tour with. You could do schools as well and, you know, kind of educate them a little bit about it and do churches, and it sounds like a really good opportunity to get yourself out there.
Well, and I'm hoping that some or all of that will come true. The heroine of the story is a retired prostitute.
Ah.
She is the one who actually saves the town from its destruction.
Mm-hmm.
And it's more or less, I'm not particularly anti-politics. I mean, my public management degree is it's a political science degree. But I think it certainly goes smoother than it's going these days. At all levels. Anyway, it should be fun to test this. I'll test it as a one-man show, maybe with a lead guitar player. And then try to scale it up at some level. But I think you're right. I think it could be presented a number of different ways concurrently. So who knows, you know? Wish I'd thought of it when I was 50. I did think of it when I was 50. I was, in my 50s when mm-hmm. I met Circuit Rider, but I'm glad you like that song.
Yeah, that's one of my favorites from the album. I want to thank you for taking the time to talk with us. And you said you have a new album that's going to come out next month. Tell us what that is real quick. Do you have a name for it yet?
I sure do miss my hair.
Okay, very cool. So it's going to have a little bit more fun, comical songs on there?
Well, it's got some love songs, and it's got, it's got some up-tempo, feel-good stuff. The first single will be called Listen to Willie at Night, and there's a song on there called Road Hard and Put Away Wet. The first two songs are really kind of a synopsis of my cancer journey, but with a positive note and good solid tempo, so I don't think anybody will go to sleep with it.
Very good. I'm going to let people know that we can hear your music, Jim Chestnut's music. It's Jim, C-H-E-S-N-U-T, no T, in the middle. JimChestnut.com is his website, and you can hear his music on iTunes, Amazon, and CD Baby.
And Spotify,
okay. Go check out his music and even try to find some maybe of his back catalog as well. So thanks again, Jim, for taking the time to talk with us on KC Cafe Radio.
I had a really good time.